Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 8.
Kierkegaard reached well back in his pseudonymous writings and edifying discourses to begin his polemic against church and society. But before 1846, when he published the Postscript, that polemical dimension of his writing remained in the background. Works of Love and the other religious writings of this period have a serene yet earnestly joyful style, but they indirectly criticize domesticated Christianity. They criticize simply by describing the real article. They represent, as Kierkegaard put it at one point, thoughts that wound from behind. In Two Ages, the first book he published after acknowledging the pseudonymous writing as his own, he begins the frontal assault in his era. Two Ages, though ostensibly a review of a novel, contrasts the Denmark of his day with the Denmark of the previous generation, an earlier time that Kierkegaard calls a revolutionary age. The earlier generation had been passionate and active, but Kierkegaard finds the present one reflective and passive. We should recall that reflectivity and passivity are exactly the traits Kierkegaard criticizes in Hegelians. Hegel's philosophy, and especially its tendency to be abstract and self-forgetful, is merely a symptom of a broader social illness. This illness shows up even more ominously in the public, that abstract entity that is both all-powerful and invisible.
The public is not a people, not a generation, not one's age, not a congregation, not an association, not some particular persons. For all these are what they are, only by being concretions. The public is all and nothing, the most dangerous of all powers and the most meaningless. One may speak to a whole nation in the name of the public, and yet the public is less than one ever so insignificant actual human being.
The public is an anonymous they that functions as the final arbiter of fashion, in clothing, in politics, art, and literature. Kierkegaard anticipates a number of 20th century philosophers, notably Martin Heidegger and José Ortega y Gasset, when he associates the public's rise with the development of mass communications. Newspapers, in his day the primary tool of mass communication, attempt to maximize circulation by publishing anonymous articles tailored to the lowest common denominator of taste. Kierkegaard says the press has lifted mediocrity up to authority, and they've loosed on society the demon of leveling. They systematically suppress any difference and distinction, any rise above the ordinary and customary. When we add together this spirit of leveling with the public's insatiable need for diversion and the press's eagerness to provide it, we have all the ingredients for the Corsair's attack on Kierkegaard.
If I were to imagine this public as a person, I most likely would think of one of the Roman emperors. An imposing, well-fed figure, suffering from boredom, and therefore craving only the sensate titillation of laughter. So this person, more sluggish than he is evil, but negatively domineering, saunters around looking for variety. Anyone who has read the ancient authors knows how many things an emperor could think up to beguile the time. In the same way, the public keeps a dog for its amusement. This dog is the contemptible part of the literary world. If a superior person shows up, perhaps even a man of distinction, the dog is goaded to attack him, and then the fun begins. The nasty dog tears at the coattails, indulges in all sorts of rough tricks, until the public is tired of it and says, "That is enough now." So the public has done its leveling. The superior one, the stronger one, has been mistreated. And the dog, well, it remains a dog that even the public holds in contempt. And the public is unrepentant. For after all, it was not the public. In fact, it was the dog.
Kierkegaard sees in the public the social and political symptoms of a deeper religious malady. He says the public is the natural consequence of Christendom. To address this problem at its deepest roots requires a clear, forceful statement of true Christianity. He must also denounce the imposter, official Christianity. Surprisingly, Kierkegaard again resorted to a pseudonym, Anticlimacus, when he published two important books, The Sickness Unto Death and Practice in Christianity. but this time the pseudonym functions in a very different way. Kierkegaard previously had used pseudonyms to express viewpoints that were not Christian and which he'd already left behind. But Anticlimacus writes from an uncompromising Christian perspective. Kierkegaard was reluctant to claim this perspective for himself because he didn't measure up to its demands. But Kierkegaard endorsed everything Anticlimacus has to say, so he placed his own name on the title page of the two books as editor. The first, The Sickness Unto Death, is subtitled A Christian Psychological Exposition for Upbuilding and Awakening. It was published in 1849. The opening paragraphs are among the densest passages in Kierkegaard's writings. It's intellectually demanding, but it's not an abstract, disinterested piece of scholarship. Rather, it concerns the most existentially relevant of issues. Anticlimacus tells us in the preface that the book resembles the speech of a doctor at the sickbed of a gravely ill patient. But the illness under consideration here is no physical malady. It's despair, the true sickness unto death.
Only the Christian knows what is meant by the sickness unto death. As a Christian, he gained a courage that the natural man does not know. And he gained this courage by learning to fear the even more horrifying. This is the way a person always gains courage. When he fears a greater danger, he always has the courage to face a lesser one. When he is exceedingly afraid of one danger, it is as if the others did not exist at all. But the most appalling danger that the Christian has learned to know is the sickness unto death.
In some of his most penetrating writing, Kierkegaard analyzes despair as the self's misrelation to itself, the self's failure to accept itself as it is. But this has further implications. Because we didn't create ourselves, but were created by God, the self's misrelation to itself is also a misrelation to God. Here we learn why despair is the true sickness unto death, the danger so horrifying that all others pale to insignificance beside it. Despair is sin. It's estrangement from the source of our very being. Anticlimacus says that one form of despair is especially characteristic of Christendom. It produces the crowd. This despair, Anticlimacus tells us, is a spiritlessness so profound it doesn't even recognize itself as despair.
An individual is furthest from being conscious of himself as spirit when he is ignorant of being in despair. But precisely this, not to be conscious of oneself as spirit, is despair, which is spiritlessness, whether the state is a thoroughgoing moribundity, a merely vegetative life, or an intense energetic life, the secret of which is still despair. In the latter case, the individual in despair is like the consumptive. When the illness is most critical, he feels well, considers himself to be in excellent health, and perhaps seems to others to radiate health. This form of despair, ignorance of it, is the most common in the world. Indeed, what we call the world, or more exactly, what Christianity calls the world, paganism and the natural man in Christendom, paganism as it was historically and is, and paganism in Christendom is precisely this kind of despair, is despair, but is ignorant of the fact.
This despairing spiritlessness, this ignorance of what it is to be a self and what it is to be an individual before God, is precisely what creates the crowd, the public, the mass man.
There is so much talk about human distress and wretchedness. I try to understand it, and have also had some intimate acquaintance with it. There is so much talk about wasting a life. But only that person's life was wasted who went on living so deceived by life's joys or its sorrows that he never became decisively and eternally conscious as spirit, as self, or, what amounts to the same thing, never became aware, and, in the deepest sense, never gained the impression that there is a God, and that he himself, his self, exists before God. What wretchedness that so many go on living this way, cheated of this most blessed of thoughts. What wretchedness that we are engrossed in, or encourage the human throng to be engrossed in, everything else, using them to supply the energy for the drama of life, but never reminding them of this blessedness. What wretchedness that they are lumped together and deceived instead of being split apart, so that each individual may gain the highest, the only thing worth living for, and enough to live in for an eternity. I think that I could weep an eternity over the existence of such wretchedness.
Anticlimacus later continues in the same vein.
Surrounded by hordes of men, absorbed in all sorts of secular matters, more and more shrewd about the ways of the world, such a person forgets himself, forgets his name divinely understood, does not dare to believe in himself, finds it too hazardous to be himself, and far easier and safer to be like the others, to become a copy, a number, a mass man.
But why is the spiritless life of the crowd, of the public, so much more evident in supposedly Christian countries than in overtly pagan ones? Anticlimacus says it's caused by a corrupted memory of Christ's incarnation and a perverted understanding of Christ as the God-man.
If men are first permitted to run together in what Aristotle calls the animal category, the crowd, then this abstraction, instead of being less than nothing, even less than the most insignificant individual human being, comes to be regarded as being something. Then it does not take long before this abstraction becomes God. And then, philosophically viewed, the doctrine of the God-man is correct. Then, just as we have learned that in governments the masses intimidate the king, and the newspapers intimidate the cabinet ministers, so we have finally discovered that the sum of all men intimidates God. This is then called the doctrine of the God-man, or that God and man are the same. Of course, some of the philosophers who were involved in spreading the teaching about the predominance of the generation over the individual turn away in disgust when their teaching has so degenerated that the mob is the God-man. But these philosophers forget that it is still their doctrine. They ignore that it was not more true when the upper class accepted it, when the elite of the upper class, or a select circle of philosophers, was the incarnation.
Anticlimacus asserts it's not Christianity itself, but rather the pale imitation of Christianity preached in Christendom that invites the crowd and the cultural elite to deify themselves.
Christendom's basic trouble is really Christianity, that the teaching about the God-man is profaned by being preached day in and day out, that the qualitative difference between God and man is pantheistically abolished. No teaching on earth has ever really brought God and man so close together as Christianity. But neither has any teaching ever protected itself so painstakingly against the most dreadful of blasphemies, that after God has taken this step, it should be taken in vain, as if it all merges into one, God and man. Never has any teaching been protected in the same way as Christianity, which protects itself by means of the offense. Woe to the babblers, woe to the loose thinkers, and woe, woe to all the hangers-on who have learned from them and praised them.
Anticlimacus's second book, Practice in Christianity, pursues this suggestion that the essential test of faith is to acknowledge and endure the scandal of man becoming one with God. Yet Anticlimacus says Christendom has systematically eliminated the scandal from the concept of the God-man. Kierkegaard had discussed this in Johannes Climacus's Fragments and Postscript. He said that Jesus, the man who claimed to be God incarnate, is a paradox, with a capital P. The paradox for Johannes Climacus was conceptual and metaphysical. It's the paradox that one being could be both eternal and historical. But now the paradox for Anticlimacus has a much more concrete and social cast. He finds it paradoxical that God would choose to become incarnate as an itinerant Judean carpenter, that he came to earth as the lowest of the low.
The possibility of the essential offense has to do with lowliness, with the fact that one who gives himself out to be God shows himself to be the poor and suffering, and at the last, the impotent man.
The possibility of offense is compounded by this lowly, humiliated man's claim to be not only God, but to be our hope and refuge. How strange, how scandalous it is that this man who has no wealth, no station, no place even to lay his head, goes about the land claiming, "Come hither to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest." Anticlimacus asks of this line,
"Who spoke these words of invitation?" "Jesus Christ." "Which Jesus Christ? The Jesus Christ who sits in glory at the right hand of the Father?" "No. From the seat of his glory he has not spoken one word. Therefore, it is Jesus Christ in his humiliation, in the state of humiliation, who spoke these words."
This is the end of Part 8. Please download Part 9 to continue.